From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Lots of noise in the streets around the world yesterday demanding strong action on climate change. Next up, a UN summit in New York. My guest today, activist and author Naomi Klein, has been in the thick of it. She's calling for a Marshall Plan for the Earth. The hour is late now, she says. Small steps won't save us. This is climate versus capitalism itself, she says. Big fossil fuel players will need to fall, new ways to rise. This hour on Point, Naomi Klein on climate change and capitalism. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Is this what it's come to? Capitalism must go to save the planet. Are you ready to consider that? Will it fly? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. We'll go into a moment, to the big picture with Naomi Klein. But first, the sound of New York City yesterday. Hundreds of thousands in the streets. There was a moment of silence and then a great noise for action on this front. Neela Banerjee is energy and environmental policy reporter for the Los Angeles Times. She was in New York yesterday, saw yesterday's march. Neela Banerjee, welcome back to On Point. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
We've got policy issues here and a UN summit. Talk to us for just a second first about what you saw on the streets of New York City yesterday.
Well, it was a surprisingly cool and misty morning, and people started lining up at Columbus Circle up Central Park West, and I stood at Columbus Circle, and I couldn't see the end of the line. I was surprised. I mean, I'm based mostly in Washington, and you become a little bit cynical about marches and demonstrations. But this was a big one. The mood was festive. The crowd was quite diverse. They tried to keep it in certain groups. It started mainly with the indigenous peoples and communities of color, people who are going to be on the front lines of the effects of climate change. They already are. And then there were all sorts of different groups. There was labor, there were youth groups, there were various communities, different states, scientists. So I continued with the march because I wanted to see it along the route. But I was looking at my Twitter feed, and it was 2:15, and people were still not... people still hadn't left the starting line. It was only, you know, as the ranks in the far back were moving up there. So it was, but, you know, it was all very good natured and quite hopeful.
We've got a UN summit this week with lots of world leaders meeting, notably not the leaders of China or India, the first and third largest polluters at this point, bracketing the United States.
Yes.
This was not the only street march around the world. There were many yesterday. For the people who work on these issues, does this kind of public demonstration change the atmosphere, or are they inside some deep bubble that this doesn't touch, Neela?
You know, I would find that hard to say. I think what it does is it kind of depends on where negotiators and government officials stand on taking action on climate change. And I think in any administration, whether it's the United States, the Chinese, the Indians, others, that there are people who want bolder, more aggressive action. There are people who have a more wait-and-see approach. And so when there is a when there are demonstrations of this scale and other events that are going on, like right now as we're talking, there's supposed to be a sit-in down at Wall Street, that it buoys those who want action, because then they can say, look, you know, people are asking for it. Those who don't, who want to take a more cautious approach, or even, you know, in our Congress, who don't want to do anything at all and question the existence of man-made climate change, I don't think they can really be moved by this.
The UN summit is to prepare the ground for a bigger Paris summit coming up next year. Are big actions on the table here? The environmentalists say there has never been enough done. Copenhagen was a flop. Do you see the blueprints and momentum for action big enough to take on the problem underway here, Neela?
Right. So what people are doing is the folks we talk to are obviously trying with us in the media and others to manage our expectations and then to explain what's going on. So what we're hearing is that what they want to do this time, and we heard this actually yesterday from I think Secretary Kerry and others at this major economies forum, is to avoid, I guess, the process of Copenhagen, which led to some chaos at the end, which means that the negotiators negotiate, and then at the very end, the heads of state come in and say, you know, we don't want this, and so there's a mess that needs to be cleaned up. What they want to do with this summit tomorrow is get a sense of where the heads of state stand, how bold and sweeping countries are, what kind of bold and sweeping steps countries are willing to take, or whether those steps are going to be more modest. And that will come from the heads of state. That it won't come from foreign ministers or environment ministers. So that's the first step, to set the tone early and have the heads of state involved early rather than at the very end. Then there's a meeting in Lima, I think, in late November, early December, when they're going to, this will be more the representatives of from various environment and foreign ministries discussing more of the details of the agreement. Then we'll see some numbers in March or the first 6 months of next year, more broadly even, when countries, including the United States, China, and India, are supposed to unveil the initiatives that they're going to propose as part of the final agreement. So then, you know, you still have another 9 months to negotiate things, and hopefully Paris will be when the agreement comes together and people sign off on it. I mean, that's what people who want action on climate change, that's the timeline and process they want to see. Whether that will happen, course, remains unclear.
A lot of noise in the streets around the world yesterday, trying to set a tone, a backdrop for those conversations, and maybe trying to move beyond those conversations. Neela Banerjee is energy and environmental policy reporter for the Los Angeles Times, with us from New York. Neela, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you again. Take care.
Here's a little more sound from the streets of New York yesterday, protesters chanting in the streets. One edge of what's being called the biggest climate change march in history. Joining me now from New York is Naomi Klein, contributing editor for Harper's, reporter for Rolling Stone, syndicated columnist for The Nation, The Guardian. She's author of The Shock Doctrine, No Logo. The Guardian calls her the star of the new American left. Her new book, which the New York Times' Mark Bittman calls the workbook for this new, more assertive, more powerful environmental movement, is This Changes Everything, Capitalism Versus the Climate. Naomi Klein, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Where are we in your assessment in terms of pace of change versus the climate challenge?
Well, I think yesterday's march was a huge step in the right direction, and it was huge. I don't think I've ever been at a larger demonstration, even the big anti-war ones. It was extraordinary, and it was also so different from any environmental protest that I've ever seen, because it was so diverse. It really looked and felt like New York City, and you had a huge representation from organized labor, which was something else that was very new. Tens of thousands of workers out there, you know, and not just nurses, like a lot of people who are on the front lines of dealing with climate impacts, but also workers who know that they will gain if governments take this crisis seriously, because there will have to be major investments in the public sphere, in new jobs, in whole new sectors of the economy. So it was a really positive message, and as Neela just said, I actually just came down from Wall Street, where there is this thousands of people are gathering to engage in direct action. So I think there's definitely a new movement rising, and it's pretty serious. But in terms of where we need to be, I mean, we're moving in the wrong direction. If we're just looking at emissions, our emissions are going up, not down. Since governments started gathering to solve this problem in 1990, since the official negotiations began, emissions are up 61%. And here we are talking about Paris in 2015, and everybody is acting as if it goes without saying that the agreement is going to be voluntary, non-binding, and it's basically, you know, just up to countries to come up and sort of volunteer what they're willing to do, which is a step backwards from the Kyoto Protocol, from the last climate treaty, which the U.S. never signed, but was a binding treaty. So it's not just that we, you know, aren't solving this. It's that we're actually backsliding, and we have to be honest about it. And that is why we have this much more urgent movement rising in the streets and going directly after the fossil fuel companies, whether it's down on Wall Street today or whether it's students demanding that their universities divest from fossil fuels. This is an impatient movement, and it's a movement of people who are directly impacted by climate change. You know, this is post-Superstorm Sandy, New York. So people on the streets were from communities that had been hit hard, communities like Red Hook and Rockaways. And, you know, they were there to tell their stories of, you know, climate change isn't some far-off, you know, abstract issue. The other thing I think we're seeing is the flip side of the fossil fuel frenzy that's going on, where we are not just not getting off fossil fuels, we're doubling down, we're, you know, with tar sands pipelines, fracking, back in oil. So a lot of the communities that were on the streets were the communities that are dealing with this directly.
What do we want? Clean air. Just a little piece of a very big rally in New York City yesterday. Marches in the streets around the world saying action now on climate change. Please, or maybe not a please, maybe just a straight up demand. We're talking this hour about global marches in the streets, the climate crisis, and our economic system, whether it must change to take on climate change. My guest, Naomi Klein, says yes. She's author of No Logo, Taking Aim at the Brand Bullies, of The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism, and her latest book, This Changes Everything, Capitalism Versus the Climate. She joins us from New York. You can read an excerpt, by the way, at our website, onpointradio.org. Naomi Klein was just down on Wall Street talking with the crowds there. She's in the studio with us now. Naomi Klein, you write, our economic system and our planetary system are now at war. What do you mean?
Well, I'll give you an example. I know it sounds a little radical to say that we have to change capitalism in order to respond to the climate crisis. But the truth is, I think all of us know that there is this clash going on. It's just that capitalism is winning and climate is losing. And we see this every time our politicians explain to us that we can't afford to take action on climate because we need to pursue policies that are based on maximizing growth. I mean, this is the language in most parts of the world. All over Europe, after the economic crisis hit, basically the planet was thrown under the bus. In government after in country after country, renewable energy policies were slashed in the name of paying back creditors, but also in the name of getting back to growth. That's the discourse. I come from Canada. My Prime Minister, Stephen Harper, won't be attending the climate summit tomorrow because he knows he's just going to get an earful about the Alberta tar sands. And he has been very frank with everybody in my country that he will not, as he puts it, sacrifice growth for in the name of climate. He says any politician who says they will is lying. So we have this clash going on. And we need to, you know, we need to resolve it. It's not that we can't have a healthy economy and also act on climate change. We can, but it's this short-term growth-driven growth at all costs, whether it comes from digging up the tar sands or whether it comes from fracking, that is putting us on this collision course. Because if the goal is just to grow the economy as fast as possible, it will be as dirty as possible. And that's why we've had this emission explosion, because that's been the reigning philosophy. So we can have a healthy economy. It can have many bit more and better jobs than we have right now. But it's also going to be an economy that is more level, where resources are more distributed. And this is why I think it is so hard to act on climate change, because the old system is so incredibly profitable for a few players, and they're defending that. Fossil fuels have always concentrated wealth. It's the story of the founding of this country. The carbon itself is concentrated in a few places. It's not everywhere. You've got to find it, and then you've got to dig it out, and that takes a lot of money. Then you've got to refine it, and that takes a lot of money. And then you've got to transport it, and that's also hugely expensive. So it lends itself towards wealth concentration, and that extraordinarily concentrated wealth is the barrier between the more distributed economy that could be built with energy sources that are everywhere, that are much cheaper to harness: wind, solar, waves.
Do you mean then that you're embracing what we've heard so much about, the green economy?
Well, I don't like that term, just because it. I think that a lot of the people who talk about the green economy sort of pretend that it's just sort of like flipping a switch from one economic model to the other without dealing with the problem that we have between the logic of this growth, short-term growth-driven model, and it's just, you know, we'll just switch from brown energy to green energy, and then we'll be done with it. They are very different systems, so it does require confronting one and confronting the outsized political influence. But yeah, I mean, this is whatever you want to call it. It's a clean economy. It's a green economy. And it's an economy, I think, that would benefit many more people than the one we have, which is why, you know, what's interesting happening today is a lot of the people, for instance, who were involved in Occupy Wall Street are now back and realizing that the same logic that foreclosed on so many homes is now foreclosing on our collective home, the same inabilities to really act on an understanding that the future is in danger. And it's not about the fact that our economic titans don't know this is a problem. Of course they do. They know, they care about their grandkids, they try to act, but they're locked within a logic that makes it very hard for them to do so, which is why this sort of counterpower is starting to amass.
I've got a lot of questions. So do our listeners. Naomi Klein's book is This Changes Everything, Capitalism Versus the Climate. Roger's calling from Atlanta, Georgia. Hi, Roger. You're on the air with Naomi Klein.
Hi, Tom. I'm not so sure if what I have is a question as much as it's a frustration. And first of all, I'd like to say that I'm very sympathetic to working to an awareness and government action on climate change. But my frustration comes from a certain a certain lack and lapse in civic life that seems to have happened over the past 10 or 15 years, where we used to mobilize around things like Klein's previous book, like, you know, the shock doctrine, where we acted against capitalism directly. And I'm wondering why that's not happening anymore. If Klein could speak to that.
Are you confused by her coming through on the climate change angle here, Roger?
No, I'm not so confused. But I mean, it seems we have a number of occasional proxy issues that just rise and then they fall. And then the major problem, which she's addressing behind all of this, like the problem behind climate change, is this mobilization of mass capitalism that's systemic, that no one can escape from. I don't understand why we can't just attack that directly.
Let us pick it up, Roger. I appreciate your call. Naomi Klein.
Well, you know, it's a good question, and you know, I think that there is a tremendous amount of frustration about why we seem so incapable of solving so many intransigent problems, and ultimately, you know, talk about it long enough, and people start talking about the enormous influence of corporate power and politics and how that system has to change. What makes me hopeful about this moment is that it isn't just that there's, you know, big climate demonstrations, that the environmental movement is growing. It's that people from so many other movements are realizing that they can form common cause around this issue, and that it has the potential to solve other problems. If we really take this crisis seriously and allow ourselves to be governed by science, which puts us on a deadline. It says we need to turn this around by the end of the decade. And I think, personally, I think deadlines can be helpful. So, you know, I think the issue of money in politics is a good example. I don't think it's, you know, it's the only issue that matters. But if there, if we dealt with that, if that was dealt with in this country, I think much more would be possible. And a lot of what puts people into a state of despair is the fact that they don't see enough going on in that area. So one of the things that I would hope is that climate could sort of form an umbrella for different movements to come together who all have an interest in getting money out of politics. And climate change just says, look, we can't afford to lose. This is an existential crisis. So if we win on that, we all win.
You want more than money out of politics. You want a different economic system.
Well, I think we need to get money out of politics in order for what most people want, which is a more just economic system. They want real job creation, not just this mindless pursuit of growth that actually doesn't translate into good jobs. I mean, this is the interesting moment we're in, is that actually more people are concerned about the failings of this economic system than they are concerned about climate change. And the fact that they're connecting the dots between the two, I think, is very good news, because there's a huge debate going on in this country about inequality, about the fact that pursuing economic growth and just short-term profits isn't trickling down for nearly enough people. And it's not just that people's salaries are stagnating, it's also that their services are eroding. So if we were to take climate change seriously, we would need huge investments in the public sphere. And that, in turn, would address inequality, because you'd have better jobs, you'd have better public infrastructure, you know, better public transit, and the people who that benefits most are the poorest people in society. And that's just, you know, one example. So I think that the fact that this sort of movement of movements moment is occurring might make listeners like Roger feel a little, should make them feel a little less hopeless. But the argument I make in my book is that the reason why we have failed to deal with this particular crisis, which is huge, admittedly, it is in part because climate change hit us at the worst possible moment in the arc of history, in that it was the late 1980s when James Hansen testified before Congress, 1988. That was the moment when sort of we lost all plausible deniability, and 87% of Americans understood that global warming, they knew what it was, the global warming was real. And that year, 1988, the planet Earth was named Man of the Year by Time magazine. And there was this feeling, okay, we're going to deal with this. The next thing that happens is the Berlin Wall collapses, the free trade era begins. It's the triumphant moment for deregulated capitalism. That's a big problem, because you do have to regulate in the face of a pollution crisis. You do have to invest in the public sphere if you're going to get off the fossil fuels that are the very foundation of the economy. Of course you do. It's a huge public works process. And yet we find out about this at the moment when we're told that there's something wrong with the very idea of government, that government is the problem, it can't be the solution. So it was the collision between that right-wing ideological project and which really waged war on the idea of the collective sphere. You know, Margaret Thatcher said there is no such thing as society, at the very moment when we most needed to act collectively within our countries and between our countries. So what I argue in the book is that climate change suffers from a case of historic bad timing. Now, the good news is the do or die moment, you know, that this is the drop dead deadline. We can't push this any further. We have to act now. It comes at a moment when the track record of that ideology is really in tatters. We know this. We don't know how to fix it yet, but we know it's a problem.
Of the free market ideology, you're saying. Mm-hmm.
Exactly, which is why you have huge debates on inequality and, you know, with books like Thomas Piketty's that document so strongly the way in which this deregulated form of capitalism has systematically concentrated wealth at the top. So now we're not talking about theory. We're talking about a track record of these policies. And so one of the things that I show in the book is that as people try to respond seriously to climate change, they have to challenge this ideology. For instance, in Germany, where you have a phenomenal energy transformation going on, where now Germany has 25% of their electricity coming from renewable energy like wind and solar, in order to accomplish this transformation in hundreds of cities and towns across the country, citizens have voted to take back their control over their power grids, over their electricity. electricity grids from the private companies that bought them in the 1990s. They still have the democratic ability to do that in Germany. And what they found is that the private operators weren't interested in switching to renewable energy fast enough. So voters in cities like Hamburg and also quite small towns decided to take their energy back or to take their power back. So this is happening now in North America and in places like Boulder. And so it's not that it's an ideological movement that's against privatization. It's a movement that wants to move to clean, renewable energy, but they're finding that in order to do that, they have to challenge one of the core tenets of the free market ideological project, which is it's always better to privatize. It's always going to be more efficient and more responsive. Not in the face of climate change, it's not.
Naomi Klein's new book is This Changes Everything, Capitalism Versus the Climate. Ted's calling from Boston. Ted, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom and Naomi. I'm a businessman, and I was down in New York with a bunch of friends and family yesterday. It was incredibly inspiring to see 315,000 people marching on this. I think, you know, I'm one of many millions of people who are just tired of waiting for action from our elected officials as we see extreme weather, you know, affecting so many from New York and the Philippines and elsewhere around the world. And I think just as the economy versus environment is a false choice, so is, I believe, capitalism versus the environment. I think we just need to retool capitalism because we can now see I can put solar in my house, and I'm going to, because it's just as cost effective. It can save just as much money, or I'll only pay the same amount of money as I would for dirty fossil fuels. So we have reached a tipping point where the economics make this. I think Paul Krugman wrote a great article yesterday about this in the Times, that it now makes sense to move forward to attack climate change. It's really one of the great financial opportunities of our lifetime. And if you go to the series website, you can see that. It's lots of companies believe that too.
Ted, I really appreciate your call. Naomi Klein, this call goes kind of right to the heart of the issue for you, because Ted says it's not an issue of capitalism versus climate change. It's a false choice. You don't think so. Why?
Well, like I said before, it's not that we can't have a healthy economy.
You're not being straightforward there. You want a change of system. I read the book. It's very clear.
Ted says
you don't need one. So please address that. Don't gloss it.
I don't intend to gloss it. The issue is we've had these technologies now for a long time. We have examples we can point to where it's working. And yet our system, as it is currently constructed, is not capable of responding rationally. I mean, I read the Paul Krugman column as well, and it assumes that we are working within a rational system that does the long-term cost-benefit analysis and says, it'll actually be cheaper to respond to climate change now than to respond later when the disasters are even more expensive. Solar's getting cheaper. Let's do it. The problem that we have is that we have a system where power and wealth is concentrated at the top, and it is systematically blocking change. There's all kinds of things that we should do because it makes economic sense. It makes more sense to invest in preventive health care than it does to deal with emergencies later on. But we have a system in which that doesn't happen. It would have made a lot of sense to re-regulate the financial sector after the financial crisis, but we have a system in which that doesn't happen. And in the same way, even though it does make economic sense, and even though, as I say, it is possible to have a much healthier economic system that has free market elements in it responding to climate change, the question is how you get from A to B. And the market itself will not get us from A to B. We need to intervene in the market to get there. And we need to reclaim our democracies to get there.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about the climate crisis and our economic system, whether it must change to take on climate change. Naomi Klein, in her latest book, says, yes, the book is This Changes Everything, Capitalism Versus the Climate. She's with us from New York. It's been quite a weekend there. Huge protest marches in the streets. Off the street, here was UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon saying he hoped world leaders would hear the call for change.
Climate change is a defining issue of our time, and there is no time to lose. If we do not take action now, we will have to pay much more.
Lots of people in the streets, including actor Mark Ruffalo.
Because of my kids, who I love dearly, and I see the world changing very quickly already. I want to do my best to give them the best world that that they deserve to have and that I was fortunate enough to come up into.
And here's another one of those in the streets yesterday. Don't have a name, but you'll get the message.
Politicians and businessmen sit around and say that they're going to do something about it, but they still haven't done anything. We need a paradigm shift. We need a different mentality towards changing this world. And I care about my future, my children's future, and humanity. And without it, climate change is just going to destroy us all.
Katie in Boston, you're on the air with Naomi Klein. Thanks for calling.
Oh, hi, Tom.
Hi.
I did participate in the march yesterday, and I've never done anything like that before. I just felt compelled to do so. And what caught my eye and what stayed with me, I followed a sign that said, there is no planet B. And I just felt that that said it all. And so now I'm taking it upon myself to, you know, as an average person, average citizen, to make my friends more aware of this, you know, write to senators, eat less meat. There were signs there, you know, about, you know, meat's not green, take shorter showers, recycle, anything that I can do, you know, myself as an individual and help spread the word and going back to, you know, there is no planet B.
Katie, I appreciate your call. There you were in New York yesterday. Naomi Klein, right in the front piece of your book, you quote Rebecca Tarbutton saying, what we're really talking about, if we're honest with ourselves, is transforming everything about the way we live on this planet. I guess your book is a hear to that, but what does it mean? Lay out in more detail for us what kind of transformation you see as necessary, Naomi.
Well, first of all, the reason why I called the book This Changes Everything is because we have reached a moment where there really are no non-radical solutions on the table. Either we are facing radical changes to our physical world, and this is what not just climate scientists are telling us, but what some of the most conservative institutions in the world are telling us. This is what the World Bank is telling us. This is what PricewaterhouseCoopers is telling us. This is what the IMF is telling us, that we are on a trajectory towards 4 to 6 degrees of warming Celsius above pre-industrial levels. Now, we've only warmed the climate by 0.7 or 0.8% so far, and we're already seeing the destabilization. So, all the climate models break down at once you get past 3 degrees, and they're saying all we have to do to get to catastrophic warming is nothing. We just have to stay on the road we're on. Just keep doing what we're doing. So, it's not that that is inevitable, but in order to get off that road, we have waited so long that there is what Michael Mann, the climate scientist at Penn State University, calls a procrastination penalty. And what that means is that greenhouse gases, if you keep emitting them, they stay in the atmosphere for hundreds of years. So because we have waited so long, we waited decades to get serious about this crisis, now we need to cut our emissions so quickly that they do challenge this fundamental logic and require that we get involved in our economy, that we manage, that we decide where we want to contract and where we want to expand. That's why the sort of market-based solutions aren't enough at this point. They would have been enough if we had started in 1988, in 1990, even in 1992 at the first Rio Earth Summit. But we waited, and that's why it now has to be more radical.
So if only radical solutions will work now, let's hear yours. Let us judge how radical it is.
Well, for instance, the fossil fuel companies, and this is, you know, the previous caller, she talked about there is no planet B, and that's also one of my favorite slogans. But the kind of things that we can do, what she talked about, you know, the way in which we can change our consumption and so on. So many people have done this, and I think it's wonderful. And we need to, you know, we need to look at our own behavior, absolutely. But the problem is that as we have changed our behavior. The corporations have been allowed to double down on some of the dirtiest fossil fuels on the planet. So what we know is that the fossil fuel industry has already has 5 times more carbon in their proven reserves, which is already counted towards their stock price, than the atmosphere can safely absorb and keep us below 2 degrees warming, which is what our governments have agreed to in previous climate summits, in Copenhagen, for instance. So if you're going to deal with with something like that. This is why gentle market mechanisms aren't enough. You actually have to have governments that are willing to close off new carbon frontiers, to say, no, you can't drill in the Arctic. No, you can't keep digging up oil from the Alberta tar sands. Things like fracking moratoriums have to be turned into bans because methane is such a potent greenhouse gas. So this type of sort of regulatory polluter pays responses, and that's the other piece of it, is that we hear part of the reason we feel so hopeless is that we're told all the time from our governments that they're broke. And we know that this transition is going to be costly. And the cost of that transition cannot be borne by regular working people by paying more for energy. They simply can't afford it, and it won't be politically acceptable. So that's why, I mean, coming back to what we were talking about earlier about money and politics, we have to go after the money, and we have politicians who are unwilling to do so because they're so beholden to those interests. There used to be that polluter pays was the slogan of the environmental movement up until the 1980s, but yet we talk so rarely about demanding that the polluters, that the fossil fuel companies who have known about this crisis for decades and have continued to deepen the crisis, we barely talk about getting more of their profits to pay for this crisis.
Though they're some of the most profitable corporations on the earth or in history, if capitalism is the culprit, then in your view, what's the alternative system that you're proposing that would be less polluting?
Well, in the book, by the way, I also go after left-wing governments that talk a good game on these issues, but are also locked within what some call the extractivist mindset. I would put Venezuela in that category. I would put Bolivia in that category. If we look at the track record of self-described socialist states of the Eastern Bloc, they also were basically at war with nature. And the big difference, the big ideological debate of modern history has been over the distribution of those spoils, not whether we can still keep acting as if the earth can
sustain. So paint the picture. If it's not that and it's not capitalism, what is it? What's the Naomi Klein vision of what would work here?
Well, look, what I do in the book is I lay out some policies that are working. I mentioned what's happening in Germany, and what we see is if you put in a bold national plan, in Germany it's a feed-in tariff program, which not only has managed to switch the economy over to the electricity to 25% renewable energies in a remarkably short period of time, we're talking about a decade and a half, and they're hoping to get to 60% by 2030, and it looks like they're on target for that. That is a really, really well-designed piece of policy because it encourages small players to get involved, local municipalities to benefit directly. So not only do they have clean energy and fight climate change, but they get to keep the resources, the money from generating that energy in their
communities. But Germany is still capitalist. So are you saying, yes, that capitalism is fine, just do it the German style, or are you saying something else? Are you ducking this question? I'm asking for you to lay out a vision of the alternative system.
Oh, I know what you're asking for me. Look, this book is a diagnosis of the problem, and it's pointing towards the people who are on the front lines of the solutions. I'm not Lenin. It is not a 10-point plan What is the alternative to capitalism?
That you are promoting.
Well, look, I think what's clear is that social democratic countries, the Scandinavian countries, for instance, Germany, which has never fully embraced deregulated capitalism, are further along because they are willing to break the rules. They haven't privatized all their energy, so they have more freedom to transform their energy systems. If you hand over your energy system to private players that are driven strictly by profit, then you're not going to have that kind of freedom to do that.
So are you talking about going back to American capitalism circa 1975, 65, 55, when there was much more regulation, or something different?
Well, I think we do need to have the argument I make in the book is that we're not going to get anywhere unless we are willing to stand up to the ideology behind the failure. And that's why the ideology of deregulation and privatization needs to be named as a barrier to progress. But actually, as I said earlier, I think it's too late for I'm sorry if it's inconvenient, but it's too late to just return to the economy of the 1950s or whatever. in part because that was a growth-based Keynesian model, and we now need to cut our emissions by between 8 and 10% a year, according to top scientists from the Tyndall Center. This is in not everywhere in the world, but in the wealthy countries that have been emitting for longer, we need to cut deeper if we are going to ask the same of China and India, or else they simply won't do it. And if we do that, then we need to manage our economies in a way that we no longer we've lost the art of doing. So that means saying no to the fossil fuel companies. And to come back to Germany, yes, they've been willing to bend the rules within a market economy. But what Merkel has been unwilling to do is stand up to the coal lobby. So even as the demand for coal in Germany reduces, the coal companies are continuing to dig up a very dirty form of coal called lignite coal, and they are exporting it. So because of that, even in the midst of this extraordinary energy transformation that is held up by everybody as the example of what we need to do, Germany's emissions went up for the past 2 years. So what that shows is we can't just put in those gentle market mechanisms and let the market fix it to us. We have to say yes to what works, and that's what a national feed-in tariff program can do. But we also have to say no to what we don't want, and that means closing off fossil fuel frontiers. So, you know, we know where to start. We know what will yield results. We know the fossil fuel companies, if left to their own devices, will dig up more carbon than the atmosphere can absorb. But in terms of sketching out exactly what the post-capitalist economy looks like, I will leave it to somebody else to write that book. That's not what this book is. I've never wanted to be Lenin. That's not who I am. I am first and foremost a reporter, and I've gone to the places that I think are already showing us that these solutions are possible.
You do say we're going to have to back off of our consumer society, that part of the transformation you envision would include that.
The problem is that we've waited so long that we now need to move so quickly to roll out the renewable energy economy that can get us off fossil fuels by mid-century, that because we have an economy that is based on fossil fuels, we have to, we are in this catch-22 where we have to burn carbon in order to get off carbon. The kind of energy transformation that we're talking about, you know, building, not just rolling out renewable energy, but also, an incredible mass transit system, light rail system, the way we have to reimagine our transit system so that we're not dependent on fossil fuels. This is a massive public works project of the kind that hasn't been seen since the post-depression era and World War II. It's huge. That is going to burn a lot of carbon in the short term in order to get off carbon in the longer term. And so that's where the sort of green growth boosters are actually refusing to look at the numbers. Because if you're looking at the numbers, what you understand is that it's not just enough to roll out this shiny green economy, because that in and of itself will burn enough carbon. So we actually have to consume less. We have to deal with the demand side as well.
Chuck in West Palm Beach, Florida, you're on the air with Naomi Klein.
Yes, I just feel as hard as you have pressed your guest to say what the alternative is. She won't say socialist, and that's to me what she's predicting, is to move us toward a socialist society. You say you're going after the wealth. Where is the wealth in Saudi Arabia? Are they going to be contributors to this pollution? Is Bolivia or is Venezuela? I don't think so. I'll wait for your answer.
Chuck, I appreciate your call. Naomi, how do you see the politics of this breaking down? What you're describing is kind of what, if you listen to, let's say, right-wing conservative talk radio, this is exactly what they always have warned about. They said the environmentalists want to take away your pickup truck. They want to take away your free market. They want to bring in social. How do the politics of this work out?
Well, first of all, the reason why I'm not saying socialism is the answer is precisely because when we look at real world state socialist economies, whether during the Soviet era or today in Latin America, they are still extractivist economies. It's essentially, as I said, it's a debate about how you distribute the spoils. But in terms of a growth-based system that is at the heart of the problem, they haven't resolved it.
But you are saying somewhere in the book, you say you've got to slap the hand of Adam Smith here, that free markets don't do it. So it's got to be planned. And you
no,
say,
look, and you mentioned the right wing. Mm-hmm. That's right. And planning is a dirty word in post-Reagan America. And you know, I spend time with the climate change deniers on the right, and report on some of their conferences in the book. Mm-hmm. And what I argue actually is that they have understood for a very long time that if the climate science is true. And we need to cut our emissions as much as scientists are telling us we need to. And if indeed industrial capitalism is destabilizing the life support systems that we all depend on, then their ideological project of pushing for ever so-called freer markets and of vilifying collective action as quasi-socialists, which are the basic talking points mm-hmm. of Fox News and Rush Limbaugh, that they're in big trouble. And so they face a choice. Either they accept the science and then have to challenge their worldview, or they deny the science and their worldview is intact. And they are choosing to do that for obvious reasons. I am saying, you know what? It is, they have a lot to be afraid of.
Yeah, we all do, as outlined in Naomi Klein's new book. You see the politics turning your way on a pace? We just got a few seconds here. On a pace that would keep up with the urgency of change?
You know, politics is nonlinear, much like climate science. I mean, this is what the climate scientists are always telling us. There's only so much they can predict, and then at a certain point, things start going crazy. Well, having been involved in social movements my whole life, I know social movements are nonlinear. There are tipping points that we hit.
And we may be at one now. Naomi, we're out of time.
We may be at one now.
Naomi Klein's new book is This Changes Everything, Capitalism versus the Climate. Naomi, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.